Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic and enthusiastic SIFF attendee.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that will watch movies of all kinds, from the latest Hollywood stab at popular success to the most arcane, hard-to-comprehend personal statement from a director typically known only to those who crave singularly independent productions. The former is what we tend to get in our local mainstream theaters, this past week's main example being The Devil Wears Prada 2. The latter is exemplified by what is happening this week through May 17th in Seattle, namely the 52nd Seattle International Film Festival. Let's begin this show by tackling something wholesomely popular. It was 20 years ago when we were first introduced to the characters in director David Frankel's adaptation of Lauren Weisberger's 2003 novel, The Devil Wears Prada. Weisberger once worked as a personal assistant to Vogue editor Anna Wintour, so the book was widely seen as a roman à clef. Whatever the truth of that, it starred Meryl Streep as Miranda Priestly, an imperious editor of a fashion magazine called Runway, Anne Hathaway as her assistant, Andrea, Emily Blunt as Miranda's senior assistant, Emily, and Stanley Tucci as the magazine's art director, Nigel. 2 decades later, Andrea has lost her job at a news magazine, returns to Miranda's employ, and again she must put up with her boss's haughty demeanor while trying both to get back to what she considers serious journalism and yet to save Runway from ruin. The result is pretty much what you expect, which is to say, it's not as bad as such a retread might have been.
Well, that's high praise, Dan. I'm just saying. There are some things to really like about The Devil Wears Prada 2. And I think it's trying to make some commentary on the state of journalism in the world as, Andy loses her job and, tries to pivot and should she go backwards, so to speak, and return to Runway. And they sort of make her some promises that, she feels as though maybe she can do this. But here's what I struggled with in this particular version. In the original version of The Devil Wears Prada, we had this Miranda Priestly character, and she was so snarky and so condescending, and she was just like Cruella de Vil. I mean, that sort of character. And I really liked that about it. And here, Meryl Streep is playing this in a way that she's definitely more questioning at this stage of her career. What's she going to do? How is she going to approach things? And that was good. I appreciated that. But as a result, there was no other character in this film that sort of picked up the snark factor to my way of thinking. The Emily Blunt character, Emily, just becomes mean and vapid and there's just not enough tension between or among the protagonists in this particular film. So there's familiarity. It's beautiful, of course, if you're into things such as the Met Gala, I guess, and all of the NFL players and the NBA players, have to dress up every week to say nothing of the draft and so forth. So there's that thing going on that, is still seemingly pervasive in the world. I liked Anne Hathaway a lot in The Devil Wears Prada 2. They made an interesting choice to cast an Australian actor as her love interest. I mean, he's a very unknown actor. And so I thought that was kind of an audacious choice. I think it's Patrick Bramall. And so you may remember that Adrien Grenier was her love interest, the bad boyfriend in the first movie. So there are things that, beautiful shots of New York, of course, a lot of cameo performances, including one by Lady Gaga, and a whole raft of designers and other celebrities and so forth.
And social media influencers, yes. Who I love to see in movies.
Oh, and then the most important thing was we had Justin Theroux playing this billionaire.
Jeff Bezos type.
Yes, exactly.
With hair.
Yeah. Now, there was one person I liked in this film for a variety of reasons, and that was Lucy Liu. So she was unexpected showing up as an ex who has this fortune of her own.
I think it was the first time I'd ever seen Lucy Liu smile in a movie.
Yeah. But overall, I was disappointed.
I forgot Lucy Liu was in this until you said that. Yeah, I found this movie, Devil Wears Prada 2, to be of extremely limited interest and consequence.
Thank you.
I mean, it's only about 10 minutes longer than the original Devil Wears Prada. It feels twice as long. And as you mentioned, it kind of starts with this discussion of the current state of journalism. And I thought, okay, well, that's an interesting way to update, you know, these characters and put them in a current environment. And it's not just that Andy gets fired from her job. Her entire team gets let go right as she's won a major journalism award for a piece that she's
written. In the midst of the ceremony.
Yes. And then the plot itself begins to concern Runway Magazine as it's being dismantled. And then everyone there bands together to save it because its legacy as a print publication is important. But most of that plot involves all of these business deals with people sitting around tables and negotiating, and it's not exactly riveting stuff. And yet, despite all that, the stakes of this movie never feel high. The movie itself, I didn't think, had very much energy. There's energy in some of the performances, as you mentioned, and I have no fault with the leads of this movie, but we'll get to that later. I just thought this felt perfunctory. I don't think it adopts an attitude about any of its themes, certainly none of its characters. I actually started to feel contempt for these people because it's like, oh no, there's budget cuts. Miranda can't fly private anymore. Like, spare me.
Yeah.
And there's a point where Andy, the Anne Hathaway character, has a line about the corporatization of every piece of society, including journalism. And I thought maybe they were going to start making a commentary about this kind of movie, but I don't think it is. I think the movie is just corporate movie making, and I don't think it's a very good example.
All you had to do is look at where these people, where these characters lived, and you see their privileged lives they have. And I'm sorry, even at the first film, I don't have a whole lot of interest in these kinds of movies. You know,
you're so fashion forward.
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. Call him Mr. Hoodie.
Cargo shorts are in again. MP. Yes. I don't know if you heard.
Josh Johnson.
The one thing that I will say is, and we can get into this further, I like Meryl Streep. And I thought her performance was terrific.
National Treasure.
You know, the character, she starts off as beastly as Miranda Priestley was in the first film. And she's got this idea that she's going to get a step up even more and she'll have more power. And she gets brought down. And that humanizes her. I thought that was probably the best part of the movie for me because these characters, otherwise, I had no use for any of them.
What about her Field of Dreams husband played by
Kenneth Branagh.
Well, but even before Miranda does get, you know, betrayed, essentially, which happened to the Stanley Tucci character in the first movie, she felt soft and almost defanged in this movie. And I thought maybe that was going to be the point. But the movie doesn't have anything to say about that. And as for Kenneth Branagh as her new husband or boyfriend, you start wondering, how did the two of them ever connect in the first place? Because he seems like the nicest man in the world. I don't think the movie ever found a really good, again, attitude towards Miranda Priestley. As for some of the supporting characters here, Justin Theroux, who you mentioned as this goofy fashion designer who gets engaged to the
Emily Blunt
character.
He's virtually unrecognizable.
Then BJ Novak shows up as the tech bro who takes over Runway's parent company. He's going to sell it for parts. I thought they were both awful in this. I thought Justin Theroux's performance, it's supposed to be funny, I think, not funny. And every time they showed up, I thought, all the airtime they're taking up, I get why they're necessary for the plot, but all the airtime they're taking up could have gone back into the relationships between Anne Hathaway and Meryl Streep and Anne Hathaway and Emily Blunt, which was the whole point of the first movie and the reason why anyone likes them.
Until the very end.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, was troubling as well. So it took some of the best parts of The Devil Wears Prada, the original.
There were good parts.
20 years ago. Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
But I think we've already spent much more time talking about a movie that is so inconsequential and so emblematic of what Hollywood tries to do. It's just simple, ridiculous entertainment.
Webster, get with the senior looks maxing thing.
Yeah, really.
You need to jump on it.
Well, here's the thing. I didn't think this was entertainment. I didn't think this was fun. And that's kind of all I was hoping it would be. I thought it would be sort of a fizzy, good-looking movie set in the fashion world like the first one was. And I'll say, I'm not the biggest fan of the original, but I think the performances, I mean, the cast they put together for that original, it's just, you know, all stars. This was just an excuse to get the gang back together. And I don't think they do anything in this that they didn't do better in the first
one. Right. And I think ultimately, Nigel should have had a different role to play in this particular film, because
the character played by Stanley Tucci.
Yes, because he's sort of just wandering through it. I mean, we kind of predict what's going to happen, but still, at the same time, I was hoping that would pop a bit more.
And I'll give Stanley Tucci credit. The few times I did laugh in this movie, it was because of him.
Oh, yeah.
I agree.
The line delivery. The guy has great timing. Well, that was probably everything you didn't need to know about The Devil Wears Prada 2. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to give a preview of the upcoming Seattle International Film Festival. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Brendan McMurphy, sales manager at Spokane Public Radio. Our listeners crave all things local. Local news, music, arts, and culture. And they love to support local business. Program underwriting with SPR is a win-win. Your business support sustains public radio while we connect you with our audience. To learn more about business support or to become a program underwriter, email me at underwriting@kppx.org. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthar, Nathan Weinbin, and I talked about the sequel, The Devil Wears Prada 2. Let's now turn to one of the Pacific Northwest's premier movie events, the Seattle International Film Festival, which this weekend begins its 52nd celebration. It was on May 14, 1976, that the first SIFF began. Founded by Dan Ireland and Daryl McDonald, the festival over the years grew into one of the premier events in the country, if not the world. This year's event isn't as long or as big as in some years, reflecting the changes that time has wrought, but it will show some 203 films from 71 countries. Broken down, that amounts to 71 narrative features, 34 documentaries, and 98 shorts stretched over 11 different programs, of which 18 are world premieres, 12 North American premieres, and 10 U.S. premieres. So, what else can we say, guys?
Well, what we should say is that we will actually be at the festival in person. I try and go every year. You guys haven't been for a while.
Well, because it interfered with my academic schedule.
Yes.
But now...
Not a problem
anymore. But we have been going since the early 90s.
Right,
so.
Right. So we'll all be there, and we'll have more coverage later when we've actually seen stuff in person. But one of the nice things about being an accredited press member with SIFF is that you get the opportunity to preview a bunch of stuff that's on the schedule. And so that's what we're going to be talking about today, movies that we've actually seen in advance or some we're actually looking forward to but have not seen yet. So I've watched a bunch of stuff already. I haven't seen anything staggeringly great yet. I'm hoping I will still encounter one at the festival proper. But I think my favorite of all the movies that I have previewed is a movie called Happy Birthday, which was directed by Sarah Goher. It's set in contemporary Cairo. And it's about a friendship between two little girls, one who lives with her divorced, probably upper middle class mother, and another who works illegally as the mother's maid. Now, these kids are both 7 or 8 years old. And it hinges on the wealthier girl's upcoming birthday. And the little girl who's the maid is helping the mother prepare for the occasion.
Yeah, she's basically an indentured servant.
Yes.
Yeah.
But she views the daughter as her friend.
Yes, the two little girls are friends, and so she gets a new dress to go to the party. She's all excited, and the little girl whose birthday it is excited for her friend to come. They don't really understand the class disparity, right?
Right.
But then she realizes that she may not be invited because of that class disparity, and so she sets off that night to try and make it to the party before it ends. And so it starts off as this very cute child's eye view of the world, even though there's obviously some darker things going on, has this remarkable child performance by an actress named Doha Ramadan. But then it ends in a way that is very sad and very cutting in its commentary on those disparities. And so I was really taken with this one. So this was my favorite of the movies that we've watched so far. Again, it's called Happy Birthday.
Yeah, we had the opportunity to see Happy Birthday at the Palm Springs International Festival. And it won some sort of award, and we didn't actually get to see it until the very last day when they screened the award winners. And we, too, were very taken with this particular
That's
film.
That's a great performance by a young little girl.
Oh, yeah. An all-timer.
She's so good. Yeah, exactly.
I was looking forward always, of course, to docs. And we did have the opportunity to see this documentary called...
How to Repay You?
Yes. Thank you, Dan, for jumping in there. And it is filmed in a very intriguing way because it sort of is very stylistic and artistic, but it's about gay cowboys, gauchos in Mexico. The filmmaker appears in the movie and he is reaching out to these other guys to try to figure out how did they come to the realization that they were gay? How are they going to navigate this landscape of
how did they out to their families?
What happened? This real machismo culture in which they find themselves. And there was something that was really endearing to me about this film. Mm-hmm. The production value isn't necessarily the best, but it feels very authentic.
Yeah, it's hardly a great documentary, but it is an intriguing one about a subculture that I knew nothing about. So I feel like I learned a lot.
What's the title of that one again?
It's called Jaripeo.
Okay.
Jaripeo. The one I'll mention is a movie called Three Goodbyes. And I have to mention it because Mary Pat and I always try to seek out Italian films wherever we see it. And this one is set in Rome, and it involves a woman. At the very beginning of the film, we see her with her partner, and they break up. He's a chef. She is
She's a gym teacher.
She's a gym teacher, yeah. Exactly.
She's a former award or elite-level gymnast.
Yeah, exactly. And so we see them break up. And so the rest of the movie is basically her coming to grips with this in her life. Who is she going to be? And then something else happens in which she has to face some dire consequences. And is it a great film? No, but it's an interesting study of what this woman does. And Rome looks really great. And by the way, the Italian title is called Tre Ciotole, which is three bowls. And I don't know that I ever understood the significance of the fact that she buys these three bowls and they show up in the film. But
it's kind of got a sentimental value, sort of.
Yeah, I agree.
Kind of thing. And the lead actress in this movie, Three Goodbyes, because I really liked this one too, is Alba Rohrwacher, who is the sister of Elise Rohrwacher, who's one of my favorite current Italian filmmakers. What I liked about this one is that even though our main character is the woman that gets broken up with, it gives a surprising amount of screen time to the guy that breaks up with her.
Yeah.
And I thought the way that it handled that character was just as delicate and complex as how it shows her dealing with this.
And there's a go-between between both characters.
This young woman that knows
that
both
you
of
think
them.
You see where it's going to go, and it doesn't go there.
Yeah.
Determinedly, it does not go there.
This is a good one.
Yeah.
Again, Three Goodbyes. I'll talk about another movie that I saw. This one's from Germany. It's called Amrum, Amrum, which is named for a small town on the German North Sea. And it's from the director Fatih Akin, who's made movies like Head On and The Edge of Heaven, which I really like. And it's set in the final days of World War II. The protagonist, again, is another child. I saw quite a few of these movies told from kids' perspectives, but he's about 11 or 12. His parents are, well, let's just say they're on the losing side of history here. And it's about how the imminent fall of Nazism is affecting this community. But it focuses mainly on this kid's mission to gather all of the rationed ingredients so he can make white bread, which is the only thing that his mother, who has just given birth, wants to eat. And I'll say, forewarning, there's a lot of simulated animal death in this movie. So if that's something you'd rather not see, then this is not the movie for you. But it's in keeping with the casual cruelty that's all around this kid who is being told to stay in line and follow orders, even as he's recognizing that that's the wrong thing to do and he doesn't want to do that. So I liked this movie a lot. I think Diane Kruger is probably the only big name in the cast, but really good performances. Again, Amrum. That's another good one.
Well, and we saw a screener for a film titled If I Go, Will They Miss Me?
Yes.
And that was very intriguing because it deals with a guy who's been inside. So he's been incarcerated and he returns home. And it's sort of how does he deal with his new reality? But it's more or at least is focused in part on his relationship with his son. He wants to be a role model in a sense, or maybe a role model for what you shouldn't do. We get a little indication of how he ended up confined, and we, you know, feel as though maybe he was sort of drawn into something, but he doesn't really know how to behave completely on the outside and how to be a father and how to be a partner. So this film, If I Go, Will They Miss Me? There's also this magical realism mm-hmm. aspect to it that, and I often don't like that, but in this particular film, it did really work for me. And I thought the performances were really good.
Yeah, and let's call those out. It was written and directed by Walter Thompson Hernandez, and Big Ant, the incarcerated, formerly incarcerated individual, the father, is played by a guy named J. Alphonse Nicholson, and his son, Little Ant, Ant standing for Anthony, was played by Bodie Dell, and the mother, Lozita, is played by Danielle Brooks, and she has a pretty big part in the film also.
Yeah, I liked this one too, and you're right, it's blending mythology and dreams and maybe even nightmares at a certain point. They live under the flight path of LAX, which is a big running motif
in
throughout
a subsidized
the movie.
Housing.
Yes, in Watts. That's a good one.
And the kids running through are like in the movie Weapons.
Yeah.
You know, they're all simulating airplanes and flying away. So there's symbolism, but it doesn't beat you over the head with it.
So those are some good movies. I mean, if you happen to be in Seattle, whether you live there or you're visiting, lots of good stuff to see. I mean, there's still tons that we have yet to
see. That's right. And everything is available. If you go to SIFF.net, you can see the entire schedule. You can see what's playing every day, all the venues.
And they also have programmer picks that you can check out, which is nice. And I would give a shout out to the Secret Fest that's going to be held on May 10th and 17th. You have to sign an NDA that you won't tell reveal any details.
And we've seen some great films in the Secret Fest.
And I look forward to seeing you guys at SIFF as well.
Okay. That was our preview of the 52nd Seattle International Film Festival. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discuss The Devil Wears Prada 2. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Bratt for directing the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, and we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late science fiction writer Roger Zelazny. Don't wake me up for the end of the world unless it has some very good special effects. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.